Welcome back to the New Diplomatist Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Garrison Morato, and it is an honor to be joined today by a special guest, Dr. Jerry Hendricks, retired captain, U.S. Navy, and an expert in strategy and American security. Dr. Hendricks, it is an honor to welcome you on board the New Diplomatist Podcast. Thanks for coming on today.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here, and thank you for inviting me.
Well, it's great to have you here. And would you mind, sir, for those who may not be quite as familiar with your career or just starting to think about topics like naval security, introducing yourself and your background so they can get a better feel for your work?
All right. My pleasure. I'll make this very brief. I grew up on a dairy farm in Indiana, went to Purdue University on a naval ROTC scholarship, entered the Naval Service in 1988. I flew P-3 Orions doing anti-submarine warfare and overland surveillance and reconnaissance for the first half of my career. And then I was in Washington, D.C. doing my first major staff tour working for the Chief of Naval Operations when the planes hit the World Trade Center as well as the Pentagon. And I instantly shifted over to looking at topics dealing with homeland security and broader national security strategy. Essentially, for the second half of my career, although I did go back in command in aviation squadron as a commander, I began to work on strategic issues. So I worked numerous staff tours, including in OSD policy, working in the Office of Net Assessment, and then working for the Secretary of the Navy. But I also went back to school a couple times, went to Harvard as a federal executive fellow and got a master's degree there. Went to King's College, University of London, where I did my PhD in war studies, focusing on Theodore Roosevelt's use of the Navy as an instrument of coercive diplomacy. Because of that degree, I did my final tour in the Navy as the Director of Naval History for the last 2 years, serving as the Navy's senior historian and curator, but also continue work on strategy. And then I retired in 2014, worked 3.5 years at a think tank as the Director of the Defense Program at the Center for a New American Security. For the last 4 years, I've been a vice president at the Telemus Group, where I've consulted with industry and government clients on national security issues, and I've written widely in, you know, the National Interest, the National Review, and most recently in Foreign Policy on national security topics.
Wow. Well, it's an absolutely glittering resume and a very diverse and sweeping set of experience to bring to the table. And we're very honored to have you here. And I should mention your book as well that you published, sir, To Provide and Maintain a Navy. And I just want to say that that's definitely a highly recommended read for all our listeners. But I brought you on today, sir, to discuss your recent Foreign Policy magazine article that was published that will be appearing in the print edition, the fall issue, as well as online. Sea power makes great powers. History reveals a country's rise and decline are directly related to the heft of its Navy. So why is the United States intent on downsizing? And it's a sweeping article, and there's a lot that we could jump into from different perspectives here, but maybe just set the stage for what caused you to write the article, what some of the motivation was, obviously the downsizing of the Navy, but even beyond that, what do you see strategically that prompted you to write this piece at this particular time?
Well, I mean, it really began with the book. So thank you for mentioning it. When I wrote To Provide and Maintain a Navy, Why Naval Primacy is America's First Best Strategy, I was very frustrated. It's been 10 years of me writing about the size of the Navy and the internal structure of the Navy and the reason for a Navy. And I've been writing those things in various different magazines and journals, and quite frankly, was just simply not getting a lot of traction. And I was also realizing that writing various different shorter essays, 1,000 to 3,000 words in length, simply wasn't being able to bring it all together in one place. So I wanted to write a book. Originally, a book was almost 260 pages long, and I thought that's too large. I want this to be accessible to the American people. It's not a book for the D.C. policy crowd. It's a book that I wanted for someone to be able to sit down and read on a cross-country aircraft flight, you know, from D.C. to Los Angeles. And so I cut the book essentially in half, but the idea is it's a short treatise about why sea power should be, or have been in the past and should be again, sort of at the center of American strategy, specifically because of where the United States finds itself in the world today. So I wrote that book a year ago in December of 2020, and then, you know, really pushed it. And because of some of the things that came out of the book, I was approached by Foreign Policy, some of the writers and editors there, saying, would you like to write on, you know, again on this segment dealing with the size of the fleet and its importance? And I thought, okay, that's fine. It's a different audience. I hadn't written for Foreign Policy before, and I'm particularly anxious to sort of deepen and broaden the stream of conversation in the United States on this aspect of national security strategy. So I wrote the essay and essentially made the argument that you can look in history. I talk about the United States and our rise to dominance after World War II, when we had 6,000, nearly 700 ships in the U.S. Navy at the end of World War II, and we created an environment where literally no one was going to compete with us in the maritime environment, and they didn't compete with us realistically for the next 50 years. But we sort of rode that horse into the ground because we continually cut the size of the Navy, and it had come down and come down. You know, we went through 300 ships in 2003, and we really didn't arrest the downward trend of the size of our Navy until 2017, when we hit a low of 271 ships, sort of a low in our modern era. And what we see is that when we pass through about 350 ships back in the mid-1990s, that's when China really began to engage. They saw that we had opened this window of vulnerability, that we were no longer going to sort of protect the maritime environment or uphold the rules-based order we had created there. And so they engaged and really began to ramp up not only their commercial shipbuilding, but also their naval shipbuilding. And we, in many ways, because of our weakness in shrinking the size of the fleet, we invited the competition. And in the Foreign Policy essay, I raised the point that, you know, we should have known better, that in fact, you know, a close reading of history and looking at what had happened with the British Empire in the 1904-1905 time frame, when it drastically culled the size of its fleet in order to pay for a modernization and innovation effort that it was going through with the creation of the battleship Dreadnought and the subsequent ships that came after it, they also destabilized the international order, and they invited a competition at sea that had not existed for a century prior to that, since Great Britain established dominance after the Battle of Trafalgar. And so, you know, I wanted to raise the question so that people could think about it today, about the wisdom of sort of a divest in sunk cost infrastructure in order to invest in new capabilities. And so that really is the heart of this essay.
Well, it's an impressive article, and one of my favorite aspects is the way that you're able to blend and sort of sweep back and forth between historical example, but also present circumstance. One of the lines that really jumped out at me came pretty early on in the article, and you mentioned, and I quote, "The ability to ship goods in bulk from places where they are produced to places where they are scarce has long represented an expression of national power," unquote. And as someone who's personally of Portuguese-American descent and someone who's studied some of Portugal's maritime empire, that really hit home for me right away, that the even small and medium-sized nations, as you've said, at various points in their history, whether, you know, you mentioned Venice, you mentioned Carthage, Athens, the Dutch, at various times, all rising into great powers, pretty much on the back of their maritime trade and more specifically their ability to project naval power. And certainly, as you just mentioned, that's been a hallmark of British power and is currently a hallmark of American power. What do you see as the primary external challenge? I would suspect you would say China based on the article, but between the various aspects, what areas of our current naval outlook need expansion? Because you do mention it's not enough to divest, to invest. That quantity really does still matter in terms of covering all portions of the globe and so on. So what are some of those glaring areas that really jump out at you that you see we need an expansion of the U.S. Navy?
Well, I mean, it's not just the U.S. Navy. It is the merchant fleet. It's shipbuilding writ large in the U.S., and it's also ship repair. During the early 1980s, 1981 in particular, we made a decision as a nation that we would stop supporting civilian shipbuilding in the United States through subsidies, government subsidies. And so it was sort of a Reagan movement at that point in time to sort of cut government subsidies to various different aspects of the American economy. And in this case, it had a disastrous result. We cut back, and the U.S. shipbuilding, as well as the size of the U.S. commercial fleet, fell precipitously through the 1980s and 1990s, and the rest of the world, European countries, as well as Asian countries, specifically South Korea and Japan at that point in time, continued government subsidy to their shipbuilding industries, allowing them to undercut the prices of American shipbuilders who no longer had that sort of cushion in their system. And so what you see is a dramatic change in the number of flagged U.S. flag vessels on the open sea, as well as U.S. shipbuilding. Now, what that did is, you know, we saw a huge number of U.S. shipbuilding yards close in the United States. That took away not only skilled workers, but it also took away downstream part suppliers. So the U.S. Navy, who was then sort of limited to a smaller number of shipbuilders, some in Maine, some in Mississippi, some now on the Great Lakes, if you start looking at where they can recruit their workers from, there's not a big base of skilled workers and trades and steel welders, pipe fitters, electricians, heating and air conditioning, et cetera, associated with ships. And there's also just no small parts suppliers, which drove up the price of U.S. Navy shipbuilding. Ships today being built for the U.S. Navy, even adjusted for inflation, cost twice as much as ships that were built during the 1980s when we had the massive 600 ship buildup under President Reagan. Twice as much. We're talking about the average cost of a ship then being $1 billion. Today it's nearly $2 billion. So there's a real net hit impact on us. Now the other impact on us today is we also have almost no ship repair capacity in the United States. We have a very limited, anemic source of floating dry docks and dry docks where if a U.S. Navy ship today gets damaged for it to go to be repaired. I cite, you know, there were two ships that were damaged in 2017, two destroyers. Both ships were brought home and put into repair yards and took longer to repair than they originally had to be built and commissioned.
Wow.
That gives you a huge sense of the impact. And so if we consider today that we would go to war again with China, which I think we all have to talk about openly, obviously Admiral Phil Davidson mentioned this in March when he gave his final testimony. He was the commander of Indo-PACOM, you know, on his retirement speech to the Congress, and essentially said, hey, he thought that there was a chance that China would invade Taiwan within the next 6 years. So if you consider that scenario, you have to consider that some of U.S. Navy ships and submarines are going to be damaged in such a conflict. Where will they come to be repaired? There are virtually no ship repair yards on the West Coast outside of the U.S. Navy base in Washington and the U.S. base down in San Diego, California, whereas in the past, we had multiple ship repair yards in and around Los Angeles as well as San Francisco. Those are virtually non-existent today. So those are the broader issues. We have virtually no civilian shipbuilding, which means we don't have an industrial base, we don't have workers, we don't have part suppliers, and we don't have a ship repair system. All, you know, greatly to our disadvantage geostrategically.
Wow. Wow. And you do mention that the United States began the 20th century as a peripheral power, and you cite Theodore Roosevelt and the Great White Fleet and the naval buildup. You mentioned Congressman Carl Vinson working with FDR to expand the size of the Navy and how really that demonstrated the benefits of strategic foresight to say we need to invest in the Navy when we then launch a two-ocean war in World War II in response to the attacks at Pearl Harbor. What do you see is necessary? If you had to give a short list, say in congressional testimony, if a congressman says, what do we do about this? What is your answer to help begin fixing this from a policy standpoint?
Well, you go back to Carl Vinson, so it's a great example of how what Congress's proper role in this is. A lot of people think that, you know, somehow the U.S. Navy, you know, won World War II at the Battle of Midway or you know, we won World War II in 1939, 1940 when Carl Vinson was able to get the Two Oceans Navy Act in place, and then there were two subsequent funding bills that came out in 40 and 41 that funded a massive investment in the U.S. naval shipbuilding industrial base that began to spool up the quote-unquote great engine of democracy. So the Essex-class aircraft carriers, and I think we built some 32 of them, and then the Liberty ships for transport and combat logistics, and then the destroyers, the cruisers, and so on, you know, those things came into being because we began a massive investment ahead of World War II. We saw the writing on the wall, and we began to plan ahead for that. So so that, you know, when the Japanese did hit in December of 41, you know, we began already to produce additional ships and aircraft. Midway, which occurs, you know, just 6 months, 7 months after Pearl Harbor, is the last battle of World War II, naval battle of World War II, where we fought essentially with the existing force that we had at the beginning of the war. After that, the new aircraft carriers, the new cruisers, the new destroyers began to arrive in the fleet. And quite frankly, this is why, you know, you hear the apocryphal, or, you know, could be true, could be not true, statement of Yamamoto, you know, that all he feared was he'd awaken a sleeping giant, and that he understood that he would get 6 months to run wild in the Pacific, but after that, the Americans could really build back up and come back. That's what happened. We spooled up the engine of our economy, and it was our economy that defeated the Japanese, not necessarily just the Navy and ships and aircraft.
What do you see as potentially the danger if, for instance, the sort of short-sightedness or the lack of attention provided to fixing this problem continues into the future? You know, you do mention the massive arms buildup in China. What does it look like for an America in 2030, 2040, if this goes uncorrected and as a naval power we begin to wane? What does that look like strategically? How does that constrain our options?
Actually, 2030s and 2040s begin to look better for us, mostly because relatively they look worse for the Chinese. Chinese are in a very narrow window right now where they have to become great before they get old. Once you get into 2035, the Chinese economy essentially gets upside down and underwater, where their one-child policy, where you have one child having to support two parents and four grandparents in their dotage at that point in time. That's a very bad place. So the Chinese understand that they need to achieve their foreign policy aims and achieve the position they want for themselves in the world, the reestablishment of themselves as the Middle Kingdom, certainly as the great Asian Pacific power, quite frankly, ideally for them to become sort of the global power, the one who writes the rules. So they're in a hurry to get this done. This is why I'm particularly worried about the near-term issue, this idea of divest to invest. Because a divest to invest strategy makes an assumption that you have the time to create the new capabilities that you want for the future, but you are vacating the shelf by selling off or decommissioning older platforms now. I really think that the real threat from the Chinese is in the near term. It's in the next 6 years. It's within the Davidson window, as I've written elsewhere. And so we need to make sure that we are strong and robust now. We need to be able to grow our fleet by building new ships, but we need to maintain the present fleet by doing additional repair and modernization of our existing cruisers and destroyers, as well as our submarines. We need to find every opportunity to grow the fleet, both by retaining what we have and then adding new at the backside of it. And I think that that is our real strategic challenge right now.
Wow. Wow, very well put, very well said. And before I let you go, sir, I did want to touch on one other topic. There was a report released in March of 2020 through the Hudson Institute that you were the author of, sir, called The Sputnik Moment: Historic Lessons for Our Hypersonic Age. And I noticed that you've been recirculating this paper on social media as of late in light of some recent events regarding particularly Chinese hypersonic development, but also Russian. And I just want to make one quote here from your conclusion of that paper. You said, quote, "A Sputnik moment has become a shorthand term for the strategic realization that a nation which had thought itself ahead in a global competition suddenly has found itself in a trailing position and must struggle to catch up," unquote. Are we in a Sputnik moment with hypersonic weapons, in your opinion?
I think we are. And in fact, you know, obviously I thought that this was coming a year ago when I wrote this. Came out right at the beginning of COVID. And of course, no one noticed at that time. But I was already beginning to see the investments that the Russians and the Chinese were making in hypersonic capabilities, which are game changers. You know, when the ICBM and the IRBM was created in the 1950s, they were game changers because, as opposed to the bomber, there was no defense against the ICBM. There was no defense against a ballistic missile at that point in time. But today, we've spent the last 30 to 40 years creating defenses against ballistic missiles, hypersonic weapons, boost glide weapons that come in at greater speeds than Mach 5 and can maneuver. Essentially, there is no defense against them at this time. So they're destabilizing. And hence why I think that it is a Sputnik moment, in the same way that the ICBM changed the calculus of the 1950s. And so, you know, what I'm hoping is that people will take the lessons learned for what happened after the October 1957 launch of the Sputnik missile and satellite and look at what the Eisenhower administration did, both investing in science and education in the United States, but also investing in defense. You know, they created three major ICBM programs and two major IRBM, intermediate range ballistic missiles. They also reordered and created NASA to begin looking at civilian space and sort of replowed into the government investment in research and development and engineering at that time. I think that we need to have significant increases in investment, but I also think that that investment in R&D doesn't come at the expense of acquisition of programs already. We need to have a net-net plus-up in defense spending so that we both acquire new things at the same time that we try to maintain what we already have, as I said elsewhere. So this is the time when Americans need to demonstrate that they can walk and chew gum simultaneously.
Absolutely, absolutely. And on the more specific note, how do you feel about the current track of U.S. military development of hypersonic weapons vis-a-vis Moscow and Beijing's efforts?
Well, we've got seven major hypersonic programs ongoing right now amongst between the military services as well as civilian agencies like DARPA. We need to continue with all of them until we reach that sort of natural deselection stage. You know, we went through this again with the missiles of the 1950s and 60s, where, you know, we were developing the Atlas ICBM, and then we did the Titan ICBM, and then all of a sudden we had the major breakthrough with the Minuteman. And so we were able to sort of stand down Atlas and Titan, which were liquid-fueled rockets, to go with the solid-fueled Minuteman, and that became the preponderant ICBM that we had in our force. We need to continue to do essentially multi-streams of research and development until we have proven capability. And I think that there will be a role for the Navy. Right now, the Navy is looking at the development of a conventional prompt strike weapon that will fit not only on our new Virginia-class Block 5 submarines, but also on some surface ships like the Zumwalt-class destroyer, and possibly could be backfitted onto some of our Berks. That would greatly diversify our ability to respond and maintain a conventional deterrent against Chinese aggression at sea.
Wow. Perfect. And now, just to kind of close out the discussion, one final question, kind of a personal question to end it on, sir. As an expert in naval history, as someone who's studied naval strategy and development, if there was one figure that you could pick in American history that you say you look up to the most in the development of U.S. naval power, who would that be and why? And we'll close it out there.
Oh, without a doubt, it's Theodore Roosevelt for me. He'd been a childhood hero of mine. And then I had the chance to serve on board the aircraft carrier Theodore Roosevelt, and I actually wrote my doctoral dissertation on Theodore Roosevelt's use of the Navy. So Roosevelt, as sort of as a strategic thinker, as a writer, and as a political leader, I look to, he is the father of the modern Navy. There's a reason that Navy Day, which used to be on the calendar and still is listed on some, is listed as, you know, late October of every year, and that's because it coincides with Theodore Roosevelt's birthday. The U.S. Navy recognizes Roosevelt as our sponsor in the modern age, and he's the guy I look to and still informs me to this day on how I think about things.
Dr. Jerry Hendricks, it has been an absolute honor to host you on the New Diplomatist podcast. I do hope to have you back on again in the future, time permitting. We thank you for sharing of your expertise and of your time with the listeners. I know they appreciate it. Thanks so much for coming on the New Diplomatist podcast.
It's my pleasure, and thank you for asking me.